Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can watch today's show by going to Ustream channel and then search for Gary Null. You can listen over the telephone from anywhere in Canada and the United States by calling a simple number, 619-550-0869. Today, the latest on why red meat, once again, is bad for you. Also, what happens when you don't control your blood sugar, what it does to the brain. There's an interesting compound in broccoli that can help us in a different way than we knew before, and a single-cell algae called chlorella will decrease dietary fat absorption. A more in-depth analysis today about the truth about male and female sexual dysfunction. And we have a lot of sexual dysfunction in the United States. Michael Downey, more on that. From our environmental segment today, we are losing the battle in the state of Washington. They're astroturfing us, the grassroots movement, on the GMO labeling battle because they have millions of dollars, and the ads on Proposition 522 are putting the enormous amount of cash from the biotech, chemical, and food industries to oppose any GMO labeling. Just like in California, propaganda enough to people, and you can change them, even when they should know better, especially in a state like Washington. Well, they did it in California, and now they're doing it there, so some suggestions I'm going to give. From Naomi Klein from the New Statesman, how science is telling us all to revolt. Quote, is our relentless quest for economic growth killing the planet? Climate scientists have seen the data, and they are coming to some incendiary conclusions. I'll share that. I'm not sure how much time we'll have with some commentaries, but I have written several. Plus, I have one on the corporate state of surveillance by Ralph Nader from Counterpunch. The inner crisis of American society. What's going on with the average American when it comes to civil liberties, the militarization and of our country and the police and economic inequality from Jack Smith. An America report card. This is a challenge to those in corporate America and the media and the Bill O'Reillys who believe in American exceptionalism. Professor Dave Hodges shares a different point of view. My guest today from British Columbia will be James McKibben. Now, James McKinnon, K-I-N-N-O-N, is one of the most popular environmental and ecology leaders in the local food movement in Canada. He was the past editor of Age Busters, the magazine that launched the Occupy Wall Street movement, and was a senior contributing editor for Explore, Canada's natural outdoor publications. We're going to talk about nature as it was, as it is, and as it can be, and how we can reclaim our loss of memory of nature's splendor and wilderness. And I decided to do this after watching what happened with a group of our listeners who joined us as a part of our sister station, BAI, that we're listening right now on simulcast, and our sister station, PFW, and our sister station, KPFK, as fundraisers to help these stations. People came into nature, and it was interesting what they did the first day versus their awareness of how powerful nature was by the last day. And I was thinking, isn't it time that we reminded people what they can do? Also, I'm going to play you today a little short 2-minute piece on something that is being done for veterans who are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder. It's an ingenious idea, brilliant, and I believe that we should all get behind it. So, needless to say, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. I don't believe that people should be told what they can and cannot eat or drink. That's part of my belief in freedom of choice. We also have a right to make improper choices if we choose. Now, of course, when we do make improper choices, not from ignorance, but from conscious awareness that we're smoking or drinking or overeating or not exercising, there's always, always in your lifetime, there'll be a price that you will pay. And that's unfortunate. But better that than have people act like food Nazis and tell us what we can and can't eat or drink. Children, it's a different story. We have to guide them, and that's why I believe that all advertisement for anything that a child will ingest should be at least examined, and that there should be criteria that you cannot exploit a child's body and mind for pure commercial reasons and cause that to be the detriment of the child. Look at the obesity, diabetes epidemic, heart disease, arthritis epidemic in kids under the age of 10. And that's what happens when the so-called ethical journalist at CBS, NBC, NBC, CNN, and all the other media take in ads, any ads, soft drinks, fast foods, and then the kids watch them and the kids consume them. Now you come to the ads for adults. You're watching television. It's a Sunday. You're relaxing. You're enjoying, as you should, you're enjoying your family or friends and watching maybe a ball game. And the ad comes on. How often is it for something that's unhealthy? I decided to spend 6 hours doing nothing but watching commercials, flicking channel. 97% of all the ads were something that would actually be disadvantageous to our heart and to our body, to our brains. But once again, a person's going to be motivated by that, and then when they go into a restaurant, they're going to expect it. And then when they come home at night, instead of eating a healthy meal, going to a farmer's market or a health food store or a food co-op, they're going to buy some fast food, eat it, or throw something that's already pre-prepared, more often than not, junk, and eat it. This is one more reason why we have to pay attention to those ads and what's in them and what it does to us. This is from the American Journal of Epidemiology and also from Physicians for Responsible Medicine. Quote, consumption of red and processed meat products is associated with an increased risk of death. I'll repeat that, because those hamburgers, hot dogs, the salami on the pizzas, right? Those are the foods that we're talking about now. Consumption of red and processed meat products is associated with an increased risk of death. Researchers looked at 9 studies with years of follow-up, up to 28 years, to calculate 23% increase in death risk for those consuming the most processed meat, and 29% increase of death for those consuming the most red meat. Now, just think of those commercials where the restaurant offer you a steak and or lobster, or a steak in some form. That's red meat. So no matter how you cut it, almost all the ads are bad. And it's not that they don't have dietitians or nutritionists or scientists who are aware of this. It's just as profitable. Other studies have shown a similar link with red and processed meat and death, as well as red meat and heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. From one article from a Dr. Orsini, red meat and processed meat consumption all-cause mortality, a meta-analysis, the American Journal of Epidemiology. That's the current issue. So here's the interesting part. For those of us in the what we would consider alternative community, we're using mainstream peer-reviewed science to prove that our lifestyle and suggestions are healthy, and theirs, promoted by their medical doctors, their hospitals, their school cafeteria programs, are bad. High blood sugar, that's another killer. I mean, that's so easy to get a high blood sugar. Just have a cola or any sugar-sweetened soft drink. Immediately you're going to spike your sugar. Now, normally if you're exercising, that blood sugar will come back down. All right, that's fine. But what if you're not exercising? What if you're watching television, working at your computer, and you're having a cola? What if you also happen to have elevated homocysteine and don't know it? Elevated triglycerides and don't know it? Then you could throw yourself into a critical situation. Here is the latest from Tulane University, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. I'll quote this. High blood sugar levels, such as those linked with type 2 diabetes, make beta amyloid protein associated with Alzheimer's dramatically more toxic to cells lining blood vessels in the brain. In lay language, this means that there's growing evidence pointing to glucose levels, your blood sugar levels, and vascular damage that can lead to dementia. Quote, from a professor and chair of pharmacology at Tulane University School of Medicine, Dr. David Busaggi. Previously, it was believed that Alzheimer's disease was due to an accumulation of tangles in neurons in the brain from overproduction and reduced removal of beta amyloid protein. And then he goes on to talk about how this is giving a whole different understanding of this. So every time, this is interesting because I had this conversation with a physician whose mother has dementia, advanced dementia. And I said, what happens when your mother consumes a soft drink? I don't know. Hour later, it's okay. I said, nope. Every single choice we make in life has a cumulative effect, either constructive or destructive. You may have to have thousands of glasses of alcohol or soft drinks or hamburgers, but in time, there'll be a tipping. And by the time you notice that something is wrong, you will be 40, 50 years into a tipping. Now, some people are now seeing tipping occur in their 20s because of how heavy they're drinking, how much junk food they're consuming. When I was growing up, people had junk food, but it wasn't all the time. It was generally on the weekend. At least where I grew up, in the small town I grew up, and all my friends were the same, it was absolutely required that you have breakfast and dinner at home. And your parents, more often than not your mother, tried to prepare a healthy meal, at least to the best that they were aware. There was even propaganda then that you had to have meat 3 times a day. So it was very common to have bacon and eggs or sausage and eggs for breakfast, and then some form of grilled cheese sandwich and tomato soup for lunch, and then a roast beef or fried chicken or steak for dinner. That was common. And that's not because anyone wanted to hurt their children, but that's what they were conditioned to believe. But also, everyone I knew smoked. I mean, every home you went into, people were smoking all the time. I did a little research on my own family. I had a lot of aunts and uncles. A lot. My mother's side, my father's, were a huge family. Every single one smoked an average of 2.5 to 3 packs a day. And one of my uncles smoked 4 packs a day. Never saw him that he didn't have a cigarette. That wasn't because they thought it was bad or knew it was bad. That was because they were told that that was one way to calm your nerves. So they were doing what they thought was normal. Their doctors recommended ads in the American Journal, the Journal of the American Medical Association. I still have the ads. 46,000 doctors recommend Lucky Strikes to soothe your throat. And Marlboro had ads. Chesterfield had ads, mainly geared towards women, to get more women to smoke. So good people can do bad things. But today we're beyond that. We're way beyond that. we know everything that's bad that we're currently doing. We know what's good and not good for our body. So then it's not about the food or the ads for adults. It's about their own sense of self. Another thing that is good for us is in broccoli. There are 1,000 more studies than what people are aware of on broccoli. This comes from Georgetown Medical Center, and it's published in the PNAS, that's the Proceedings National Academy of Sciences, which is considered the most authoritative scientific body in America. And it says that the cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower give us a lot of good benefits. But like all plant foods, we're just beginning to understand that there are additional benefits being discovered all the time. Yes, we know broccoli's good, but then we discover something else and something else and something else. Well, we'll probably be doing that for the next 20 years. But this protects specifically against radiation sickness and the death that usually follows. So this is important. Now, what this is called 3, or DIM. This is a dimethyl methane, and it's found to protect the body in otherwise lethal doses of radiation. Quote, DIM could protect normal tissue during radiation therapy and protect them in a case of radiation exposure. This is from the studies. DIM has been studied as a cancer preventative agent for years, but this is the first indication that DIM can also act as a radiation protector. End quote. Wow, that's terrific. That means that if you're going in to get x-rays, any form of x-rays, including CAT scans, you should be taking DIM. And you can get it in broccoli extract or get it in any of the cruciferous extracts. Eating broccoli in and of itself would not give you enough. But today there are dozens of products that have cruciferous nutrients in them. Load up for about a week before you're going to get any x-ray, and then for 2 weeks after an x-ray. And also take a lot of vitamin C. Add vitamin C every single hour after getting any x-ray at all. And that will help to trap the radical, hydroxyl radical, which is your worst free radical. It does a lot of damage, and it will trap that and neutralize it, and therefore you won't be as sick. So that's good. And finally, chlorella. Now, chlorella, as we know, is an algae. Many people have been eating spirulina and chlorella for decades, and they've been ahead of this curve because there are thousands of studies supporting chlorella. This is the latest one, and here's what it says, and this is published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition and Research and Practice, and this was done at Wyatt Woman's University in South Korea. Chlorella is a superfood, that we know. It's a single-celled algae, and it's been used in Asian countries, Japan, China, Korea, for a long time. It's very high in protein. It's 60% protein. That's far more than any form of animal protein. And it also is high in fiber and lipids and minerals and choline. And it was known that it would reduce the risk of heart disease. In fact, going clear back to 1975, there was a study that showed that high cholesterol patients who ate more chlorella had lower cholesterol levels than their counterparts who ate less chlorella. Then in 1987, researchers found that chlorella vulgaris, garis, helped fight abnormal fat levels in the thickening of arterial walls. And then another form of chlorella lowered down the bad LDL cholesterol, hence protecting the heart. This newest study shows that chlorella lowered body fats by reducing fat absorption in the intestinal tract by 10%. That's a big deal. So for those of you who've had trouble losing weight, adding chlorella to your diet, a teaspoon in your health drink can make a difference. Now, I want to go over to the environmental section because I want to make sure we get this in. This is important because this is from the Center for the Media and Democracy Watch, and it's from Jill Richardson. Here's what it says. Washington state voters are being subjected to nonstop ads about a ballot initiative to label genetically engineered foods, Initiative 522. Most ads on 522 are sponsored by a record-breaking barrage of cash sent to their state by the biotech, chemical, and food industries that oppose it, although a few ads come from the yes side. A look into the money pouring into Washington tells an anti-democratic tale of how a once popular initiative is now statistically tied in the polls. So what is 522? The initiative would require labeling of genetically engineered foods, also known as genetically modified organisms. These are foods that have genes from a different species inserted into their DNA, like a corn plant with genes from a bacterium. Most Americans have already eaten genetically engineered food, and lots of them. An estimated 70% of all food consumed in the United States is genetically engineered. The exception is organic foods, which are prohibited from using any genetically engineered ingredients. Yet, when asked, most Americans either say they do not know if they've eaten genetically engineered foods or say they have not. Well, despite our ignorance about what we're eating, over 90% of Americans say they want labeling. Some states, like Vermont and Maine and New Hampshire, are considering bills to require labeling of genetically engineered foods in their legislatures. Connecticut has already passed such a bill, the first state in the United States to do so. Washington is letting voters decide. And then it goes on to talk about the lies of the genetic engineering and the misleading ads, and the same misleading ads they did in California. Here is our pushback. Here's what we can do. Richard Gale, one of our scholars in residence here at our office, and myself have researched and written what many consider the definitive ad, or not the definitive article, to counter the ads of the pro-GMO people. So let's just say you didn't know what the truth were, and you were a potential voter on this issue in the state of Washington, or in Vermont, or New Hampshire, or Maine. We lay out their argument, and then we deconstruct it. Every single one. Oh, it'll cause food to be more expensive. No, it won't. Oh, it's more sustainable. No, it's not. Oh, it's better for... No, it's not. So we go through every argument and show you the real science, all completely scientifically footnoted. So that's one thing we can do. The article is on the website progressiveradionetwork.com, where, by the way, just so you understand, we post almost 70 new articles every day. But if you look at the Huffington Post and you look at all these other websites out there, we don't cover any of that stuff. In fact, I was asked just yesterday, I was getting my juice at the health food store. It's kind of interesting because when you live on the Upper West Side and you work on the Upper West Side, you have to appreciate, and most people do, and that's why they're here, that this has the highest concentration of highly educated and successful people, artists, academics, business people, small business people, people with a variety of backgrounds in the entire world. From 96th Street to 57th Street, from park to park, you really have very educated people. So it's very easy to go someplace, especially meeting points, and find people talking on issues that are interesting. And in this case, there were three gentlemen, gray-haired gentlemen. I walked up to get my juice, and one of them said, "Hey, Gary, I was listening to interview Professor Norman Pollack. Just thought you'd know that he was my professor. And I thought he was one of the most brilliant men and one of the true, honest liberals." And I said, "Well, thank you." He said, "Have him on again." I said, "Well, we're going to do better than that. It looks like he may be having his own radio show along with about 40 other great minds in academia on the progressive, we're calling it the Progressive Minds Program, where they'll be rotating people that the average American has not known of, and people would never see on the corporate-controlled Democrat and corporate-controlled conservative media. They exclude these people. And he said, well, we know that. And I said, who are we talking about? He says, well, the three of us are professors at Columbia University, and we saw long ago how there was an effort to expunge true liberal academics from all of your major institutions, if not then to marginalize them. And those who have been tenured, and Noam Chomsky and a few like that, those are the exceptions. Others take a beating. And he said, especially here at Columbia. So he said, what we have is we have centrist or corporate liberal educators. And then we get into this whole discussion about how easy it is, once you control the educational system, then to influence a whole legion, a generation of students into your ideology, like the Chicago School of Economics, the Friedman School, did this. You know, it's just one of those things when you're in an area and you talk with people, there's a greater awareness. Then you start going throughout the United States, you will have pockets of people who are aware, but the vast majority of people are not. So they're very susceptible to being manipulated by the media, especially if you have some PhD or professor or medical doctor comes on and seems friendly and aware and tells you with absolute certainty that you don't need this labeled, you don't want people, you know, preventing you from being able to, you know the truth about this, and you don't see the other side of the argument. So here's my suggestion. Let's show everyone we know the other side of the argument. First, let's get them this article and all these other articles you won't see elsewhere. We take all the best progressive minds in every field, and we publish those articles every 24 hours, throughout the day and night. Secondly, we have a documentary. Never underestimate the power of the Internet to share insights and inspire social action. Seeds of Death has, in just one site, I just saw it had, I think it was 800 and some thousand downloads. That's just one. It's on dozens. And then there are people that will share it with everyone they know. So it's been seen by millions upon millions upon millions of people, but not necessarily in where we need it shown. We need this to be shown all throughout the state of Washington, Vermont, Maine, and Connecticut. That's where we need it. So if you download the article and download the film, send it out to everyone in these states that you know and tell them this will give you a way of sharing it with school teachers, with policymakers, with members of the local media, cable television, any place we can get this on to counterbalance the millions, tens of millions of dollars they're throwing at the campaign. Because if we don't do this, the same thing that happened in California is going to happen in Washington. They'll win, and we won't get that labeling law. Okay? Now, I want to take this moment to share what's going on with the inner crisis in America. How many times have we been told that, well, what's really important is what we see and hear, the network news, NPR, even some on Pacifica stations? They pretty much are parroting the corporate agenda. We don't believe in that. When we select material for the show each day, it's to empower people by giving them insights that they otherwise wouldn't have. It's not to take a right or left position. And then we have all these people who tell us these are the most important issues, and I don't believe they are. Here are some of the issues that are important that you're not being told about, and that these are not being dealt with by the politicians of either party. Number one, according to Jack Smith, the erosion of American democracy by a political system flagrantly dominated by great wealth and big corporations and Wall Street and the major banks. Now, yesterday we had a little clip from a person who came on to talk about how our politicians are owned, and they're not going to do the right thing. I absolutely believe that's correct. You can't reform a system. It has to collapse from its own corruption, but we should pull out of that system and start supporting alternative systems. Look, in other countries, you have this. In France and Greece and Spain, and you'll have dozens of other platforms and programs and parties. Here we have two, and we shouldn't. One person may have one vote, right? That's what we're told. One person, one vote. Well, yeah, but what if you're a billionaire? By virtue of funding certain candidates, that billionaire has the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of votes on election day and in the federal and state legislatures and executive office thereafter. This is more closely resembling an oligarchy. An oligarchy, by the way, is ruled by a small group of powerful people and interests than anything that represents genuine democracy. And then we have the grave weakening of civil liberties and the privacy rights of the American people by all the former administrations. They were all spying on us. And just take a look at what has happened to America. Today, America is nothing but a surveillance state. Whatever happened to the checks and balances that were supposed to exist in the U.S. political system to protect the people from such abuses? Our postal, mail, emails, internet practices, phone calls, electronic devices are all, without exception, hacked at will by the U.S. government and many law enforcement agencies. And somewhere in the United States, a Big Brother regime is patiently waiting in the wings for conditions to ripen. I believe that is going to be in the next year or two when the dollar is no longer the reserve currency. The dollar collapses overnight. You go to bed one night, you wake up the next day, your dollar's worth nothing. And then we see the corruption at every level. The smart people have already cashed out. They're already doing it now. They'll be into gold and silver, even though you've been told not to go there by the people who are supposedly the experts. No, that will be the place. And then you're going to get hit with hyperinflation. So the apparatus for being an Orwellian state is now in place. In this connection, the Washington Post said in an October 5th piece by David Sanger, the New York Times reporter who spent 20 years reporting on Washington, he said, quote, "The Obama administration is the most closed, control-freaked administration he's ever covered." You think? Well, yeah. Also, what about the rapidly rising economic inequality? This has reached the point where about half of our population right now, according to all the research I've gathered from my new documentary on Poverty, Inc., the average American, that's half of all Americans, that's about 160 million Americans, are either at, slightly above, or slightly below the poverty level. That means that about 5%, not 1%, 5% of the American population are living like royalty. Meanwhile, unemployment and foreclosures remain very high. Social programs that benefit people are on the chopping block. And how can there be a healthy democracy if there isn't enough semblance of economic democracy for the poor and the working class and the lower middle class and now the middle class itself? The big gorilla in the room is climate change. It's on us. You'll hear people coming forward out of Congress or the White House, and they'll mumble about lowering greenhouse gas emissions, but you have to have good evidence, and you have to have good science, and they need just two more cycles of reviews, and that'll take another 375 years if you're Obama, and the U.S. will shortly become what? The world's largest crude oil and natural gas producer. Why? Because this administration policies and the proliferation of hazardous fracking. Washington always demands to be recognized as a world leader, right? But now we can do it by force, and now we're leading the world toward a disaster by ignoring the climate crisis, because we will never, and I repeat this, in any of your lifetimes, we will never disrupt corporate or financial profits to protect the environment and hence protect people. It's not going to happen. And the U.S. government is determined to remain the world's military superpower. We're spending this year $1.5 trillion. We have wars going on in Afghanistan, drone wars with Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, and we're building even a greater military industrial complex. Yet we don't have any money for infrastructure, for schools. And then we say that, oh, but the Republicans and Democrats are the party of the people. Really? Are you? Which people are you talking about? None of the people I know, no one I know would ever vote for a corporate Democrat or Republican. No one I know, unless they were really stupid for a moment in time, voted for Obama. We voted for Ralph Nader. We voted for Jill Stein. But that's a separate discussion. So let's just take this just one step further. We've all heard Bill O'Reilly, when he had a chance the other day to challenge Dick Cheney, but he didn't, and on anything, and talking about American exceptionalism, that we are exceptional. We have to show the world we're exceptional. Well, in what way are we exceptional? Well, there's a report card out there. The report card was produced by Professor Dave Hodges. Here's what it shows. Let's just take some of the areas where we can be graded. How about on income and employment opportunities? Now, that's good because haven't we been told that we've got the best education, and especially if you're able to get into our Ivy League schools, and if you become one of the people with an IT degree, one of the information technology managers, hey, that's it. Wrong. We get an F. Why? Well, here's how it works. Because here are the countries in the world where you get a better income with your employment opportunity. Number one on the planet, Switzerland, then Germany, Denmark, Japan, Norway, Austria, Belgium, Ireland, and the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom. We're nowhere in there. And, oh, by the way, if you're a young adult and degreed and skilled in engineering and information technology skills, better move to another country in Western Europe, because you're not going to get that here. So we fail. We get an F. All right, well, then let's take a look at another area. How about in the area of educational opportunities? That should be good. Wrong again. We get an F there, too, according to this report, because it is easier to get a better education and a less expensive education and be able to do more with that education and get a more objective education in, ready for the top countries, Sweden, Finland, the Netherlands, Belgium, Ireland, Austria, France, Italy, Canada, Australia, then in the United States. So we may consider ourselves exceptional, but based upon grading ourselves, that's like a person running around Central Park, and all of his friends get there and put a tape, and he breaks the tape and says, I did it. I'm the greatest in the world. And someone said, well, you just ran a 12-minute mile, and everybody heaps praise on him. And someone says, well, Bannister ran a 4-minute mile, under a 4-minute mile. We just don't pay attention to ourselves compared to the rest of the world. How about our overall economic health? We get a D-. Why? Because it's just not the $17 trillion federal deficit. Look at all the unfunded and partially funded mandated social programs. That's $222 trillion. And credit default swap derivatives total $1 quadrillion. And that's more money than exists in the whole world. And so we are broke. We're bankrupt. How about on health and wellness? Well, we get an F-. We're one of the sickest countries. We have one of the worst medical industrial complex systems in the world. It's all about profit and not about helping patients live a longer, healthier life. All over the world, there are countries where people live longer lives. Australia, Canada, Ireland, New Zealand, and Norway are all tied for first. So we're way down the chain here. Well, how about civil liberties? Well, not good there either. We get an F- in civil liberties. We're down as in 49th place, right beside Romania. Oh, I don't, in what is called the Democracy Index. We're in 49th place with civil liberties. But after all, we have the Patriot Act that the Democrats love, and NADA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and several of these other draconian pieces of legislation. I would have expected this out of the Vatican in the 12th century to help guide the Inquisition. Well, we have our modern version of the Inquisition. We've lost habeas corpus. We're losing our freedom of speech rights. And yet the Homeland Department of Homeland Security was able to purchase 2.2 billion, with a B, billion rounds of high-tech bullets. And for what? And general satisfaction with the American government? F minus? So the next time someone tells you that we're exceptional, say, you bet we are, just not in the way that you want. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome everyone. I'm Gary Nall. You can always go to the archives and download any program you missed. And for, I guess, the rest of this week, on our sister station at 7 in the morning to 8, you'll be able to hear the Progressive Commentary Hour. And that's only there because it's helping to build an audience for the replacement program that will come in there, because there was no audience. None. Now there is an audience, and that's good. We're happy about that. Also, I was just informed that 1,855 people in this audience, your books are on their way. That's good news. They were paid for by the station, and they're on their way. And another way of looking at that is that brought the station $200,000 in this drive alone. That's just that premium. So we're very pleased about that. I'm going to be out on Long Island on November 17th in Huntington at the Cinema Arts Center. I'm going to be premiering The Silent Epidemic at that time. If you want to join me out there in support of the cinema arts and helping people share this information, you'll call out there and get tickets at 631-423-7610. 631-423-7610 at the Cinema Arts Center on November 17th, which is a Sunday. Let's say hello to JB. That stands for James McKinnon. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be here.
I'd given your background to our audience earlier, and I want to begin with the idea that we live today in a 10% world compared to the natural world of the past, where today children experience only a sliver of the natural world and then deduce that this is what nature and its wilderness is. And with each generation, as the human footprint increasingly diminishes biodiversity, the amount of land that is in fact wild and the collapse of ecosystems, our perception and belief of what nature is changes with each new generation. So begin, please, by speaking of that process and then taking a psychological stance. What are the consequences of how humans discover their natural relationship with nature when nature itself becomes more artificial? For example, a parent taking their child to Center Park in Manhattan, just several long blocks away, in order to experience what nature is supposed to be.
Yeah, you described the process exactly. It's a phenomenon called shifting baselines, and or shifting baseline syndrome is what they call it. And this process by which, when we're children or young people, we look around at the world around us, and we see the natural world at that time as the normal state of nature, and that becomes our baseline state for understanding what nature is throughout our lives. And through our lives, then, we may notice that there is some degradation of nature or some transformation that occurs But when the next generation comes along, they will go through exactly the same process. So they will look around themselves and see what for the previous generation is a degraded state of nature. They will, this new generation will see that as the new normal for the state of nature. And of course, this carries on generation after generation. And at the end of this long process, we completely lose sight of what nature can be, what it used to be. And my shorthand way of trying to understand that was this idea of the 10% world, because as I dug into the history of nature, or historical ecology, as it's sometimes called, and I just kept discovering in study after study that, you know, this species, that species, these fish, these ecosystems have all been reduced by about 90%. And it seemed so consistent that I started to see the world around me as this kind of 10% world. It also, I think, captures the difference in how we experience nature, the difference in what it's like to be in nature today as compared to what's described in some of these explorers' journals and sea captains' logbooks and so on that I dug through to write this book. I wanted to find a way to express that, to capture that difference in the sensory experience of being in nature. And I think the 10% world, again, captures that in a shorthand way.
Just 5 days ago, before I came back to the city, I had spent a month with members of our audience, helping them in their journey, facilitating their journey of wellness. And on the very first day in the orientation, I said, more than any workshops or personal counseling will be letting nature participate in your healing experience, your de-stressing experience, your reconnecting with what is important in your life experience. And that's why this environment was selected. There's some trees that are 150, almost 200 feet high. And on the last day, as I'm sitting with two people, one's an 84-year-old woman with serious health conditions, and leaning back and looking up, there's three bald eagles just 50 feet away, clear as can be. And then you look and you see all the other birds. And then if you're quiet, you can hear the coyotes. If you're really attentive, you can see some beaver. All that is in that natural environment. And yet we've removed ourselves more and more from the natural environment. And a lot of young people in particular are only experiencing the wonders of the natural environment when they watch it on the internet. So I'm concerned about how difficult it's become for citizens of modern civilization to have a collective memory of the true pristine wilderness of nature and the vast biodiversity it once held, whereas we can remember more easily our historical social past, such as wars and acts of violence and economic good times and bad times, then through your own personal experiments to rediscover and reclaim that lost memory of nature in order to discover your deeper relationship and respect towards what is essential for all of us. Could you take us there, please?
Yeah, I do think it's essential for all of us, and you're exactly right that it's very difficult to hold on to these collective memories of nature. I mean, it's very difficult to hold on to collective memories, period. And what I found as I looked at the psychology of how we remember as a society and as individuals, I found that nature is one of, it's really one of the hardest things for us to hang on to in our memory. It's something that we've always interpreted as being in the background of the events that take place in our lives, rather than as the focus of our attention. And memory is really a product of attention, either for individuals or for societies. What we remember is what we pay attention to in the time, and then what we pay attention to over time. And because changes to the natural world tend to be gradual, they're generational, we perceive them to be taking place in the background, they're particularly susceptible to being forgotten. And really the only I mean, I think there are two ways that we can address that. One is through really active remembering, and I think as your listeners will know, I mean, there are many issues that we simply have to work to bring into the public consciousness and into collective memory, and the natural world of the past is very much one of those things. It's something that we have to actually actively remember and actively promote in cultural remembrance. But as you said, the other step that we can take is to personally reconnect to the natural world. And you mentioned the depth of our disconnection, and I had a personal experience with that where I realized in the process of this book that I might be quite disconnected as well. I mean, I live in the heart of a city of 2 million people, and so I took a first experiment in just going down to a simple pond in the middle of a city park, and I just sat down and spent an hour paying attention to the natural world. And I ended up having this quite extraordinary experience where I was sitting and watching the ducks, and suddenly, you know, the ducks all were scrambling in all different directions and diving and paddling their way for the reeds, and something big was happening. And I didn't know quite what it was until I saw this shadow come rippling over the water, and it was a bald eagle swooping in to try to hunt these ducks. And it honed in on three of the ducks, and at the last second, the ducks kind of split into three different directions, and it came up with its talons empty. But then this very dramatic moment, you know, it's a wildlife documentary quality moment. And I looked around the pond to see, you know, to sort of share the experience with anyone else who might have seen it, and realized that no one else had seen it. You know, there were dozens of people around this little lake, people walking their dogs, throwing sticks in the water in some cases, but it was very clear that I was the only person who had actually observed what had just happened, this very dramatic event on the lake. And it's simply because I had chosen to pay attention.
Hmm. There were a group of people unique in our society that were paying attention and giving us the benefit through their drawings, their poetry. Some of the great poets, Whitman, John Muir, Robinson Jeffers, Emily Dickinson, Wordsworth, Emerson, and then many of the famous Japanese haiku and medieval Persian poets capture the wonder and awe and splendor of that natural world and reveals to us a kind of humility and respect for its raw wilderness. And one of the characteristics of postmodern society is the loss of awe and wonder towards the world around us. And rather, we show awe in the size of a billionaire's mansion or yacht, or the shock and awe of military prowess and might to level a country and utterly destroy its environment. We experience more awe and wonder at humanity's destructive character than we do of the ground beneath our feet and sky above our heads. So speak finally on the loss of positive natural examples to inspire splendor and awe in our lives, and how is this contributing to our further destruction of the planet?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as you say, we, rather than moving in any way in a direction that would start to correct our disconnection from the natural world or our tendency to forget it, we are, you know, we're constantly deepening that disconnection. As of 2008, more than half of the world's people live in urban areas. We're spending more and more time in virtual environments. We're in a sense constantly expanding a kind of world in which the only thing that we place at the center of our attention is ourselves and our own actions. And as you say, often actions that are destructive end up at the very center of our consciousness, in a sense, and the rest is pushed aside. And this is where the idea of rewilding, I think, really comes in. I mean, rewilding, this idea of essentially simply making places wild again, or making them more wild, is one that people have talked about for large landscapes and rewilding old migration routes of animals and so on and so forth. And I think those are very important rewilding concepts. But I also think we really need to look at rewilding the human landscape. And, of course, we can't return the heart of a city to what it was before in any practical sense. But we can start to try to think of all of the places that humans operate as part of an ecological community. And it's there are tremendous benefits to doing so, even very small and personal ones. I mean, to tell you about one of my own, I mean, as I started to pay closer attention to the natural world in the city where I live, I recall this one moment where it was February and the weather had been gray and cold and miserable, and lice had been throwing me a few curveballs in a row, and it was a dark and depressing time, and I needed to have that sense of spring. Spring is eventually going to come, and one day the sun will be beating down on my back again, and because I've been paying attention, close attention to the natural world through this last couple of years, I noticed that the seagulls were changing their plumage even as early as February. Were changing their plumage.
Hmm. Well, that'll brighten you up. James, we're out of time. All these wonderful stories and more can be read in The Once and Future World, Nature as It Was, as It Is, as It Could Be. The website is J.B. McKinnon, KINNON.com. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. I'll deal with the positive effects we could have upon vets who are suffering on tomorrow's program. Have a lot to share. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hi, Gary. I'm getting a lot of email from your audience about this whole issue of Obamacare. I know that you've addressed it before, and I think that now people are starting to get notices that the plan that they like, which Obama said, if you like your plan, if you like your doctor, you keep it. And he said that over and over and over again, and they have that all over the Internet now. And now people are getting notices that their health care is being dropped and they have to reapply for Obamacare. So people are reeling about this. This and also the whole the mandatory vaccine issue. People are getting angrier and angrier, Gary.
Well, that's good, because only when a system breaks down can it realistically have a new breakthrough. The problem we've had for the past 60 years is we have been enculturated to believe that we can make a difference by reforming any system that is wrong to our needs. Nothing has been further from the truth. So it's only when Wall Street and the bankers become so greedy, the military-industrial complex is so fascistic and police state-minded and totalitarian, only when we show the worst that we can be as human nature, does the system that we are part of begin to lose its credibility for those who are finally awakened by this and begin to withdraw from it and start to seek other ways of investing, other ways of eating, other ways of living, other ways of voting, and other ways of looking for the truth. So it is only with a single-payer system that we can give quality health care to the people, all people, who need it. And because that was never the intent of Obamacare, just remember, Obamacare was written, every word of it, written by the lobbyists and the lawyers for the for-profit insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and the hospital industry. And if you opposed them, you were excluded. So how they dress it up and how they get their corporate apologists within the media, whether it's The Nation magazine or MSNBC or even on Pacifica, to apologize for it is no different than how they got the Democracy Now to support the invasion of Libya or Syria. You have to differentiate a true, authentic, historical, FDR or New Deal liberal from those who disguise themselves as such. And it's we, the people, should be completely rejecting Obamacare, rejecting the politicians who supported it, rejecting the industries that supported it, and demand, through national boycotts, national strikes, a single-payer coverage. If we don't get it, we don't support them. You can't have it both ways. If you do, if you try to say, I don't like what I'm given, but I'm not going to oppose it, I'm going to continue to feed at their trough, then you're suffering from the Stockholm Syndrome. Hope that answers the question.
Sure does.
Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Hello, Luann, if you're still there. Today we're talking about Detroit as America's test case in large-scale urban removal.
Great. Well, since I've gone to Detroit so many times, and I've helped the Detroit PBS station save their butt, much as I've done BAI so many times, and I've seen it up close because when I go, I like to spend the day walking 5 or 6 or 7 hours through all the neighborhoods, stopping and talking with people, and just seeing what is the quality of their life. None of this is being put forward by the American media or any of the support groups that are out there. It's like these people don't count, and they do. Look forward to your program.
Thank you, Gary.
Utrice Lead, right now. And by the way, Utrice Lead, 20 years, having her own two-hour show every afternoon, Talk Back, which then she hired her replacement, Hugh Hamilton. Her audience now, just saw the figures this morning, is approaching 300% larger numbers than she ever had on BAI. So we're happy to see that so many people are telling other people and coming on board for her good insights.
That's great. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight.